Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Nick Hilton, and I'm joined now by Chris Mullin, whose new memoir, Hinterland, is just out in paperback, and James Forsyth. So, Chris, ahead of Labour Party conference starting on Saturday, how do you feel the Labour Party has changed in the last year? Is this conference going to be very different from last year?
I think it will be, because Jeremy's position is much more secure post the election than it was this time last year. I think he'll have a far easier ride than he's had in previous years. And the other thing, of course, is I think it's liable to be eclipsed by the goings-on in the Tory party. And it's not necessarily a bad thing for Labour conferences not to be the centre of the nation's attention, because we've had some spectacular, very exciting Labour conferences in the past when we were broadly unelectable. But if you want to be electable, it's a good idea to have a relatively quiet conference.
So, James, is the media's attention not that interested in what's going on in Brighton?
I think in the lead-up, obviously, it's been dominated by Theresa May and her Florence speech. I think in the papers at the weekend will be full of the fallout from that, the questions of, you know, where does the Brexit policy go next, and can she rally the cabinet behind it? But I think, as Chris says, one of the interesting things about this conference is this will be the first Corbynite Labour conference. In previous years, there's been a slightly odd thing, which is why the hall has not always been full for Jeremy's speech, which is conference was still dominated by those in the party who were most sceptical about Corbyn and his leadership. I think that has now changed, partly because the Corbynites have got organised, they've won constituency nominations to send people to conference. And the second thing is, a lot of people in the Labour Party's reservations about Jeremy Corbyn were not actually about, you know, his morals or his politics. They were about his electability. And the fact that Labour got 40% at the election, which no one saw coming, has, I think, changed that argument around. There is a sense in the Labour Party that they are one more heave away from victory. And I think it's a sense that is being enhanced by the lack of Tory unity at the moment. You know, it does look like the Tories are ripping themselves apart over Europe. And if Labour can hold its nerve, they will win, and win a victory that no one would have thought possible when Jeremy Corbyn first became Labour leader.
And Chris, I think you mentioned in Hinterland that you didn't see Jeremy Corbyn as an electable leader. Is that something you wish you could have changed between hardback and paperback edition?
Hinterland was written before the election. And although I've known Jeremy really for 35 years, and he's a lovely human being, and thoroughly decent fellow who's lived a modest life according to his principles, but I considered him to be unelectable. And I think I was clearly wrong about that. I take comfort in the fact that I was perhaps not the only person to be wrong about that. And I agree with what James just said, that conference is going to be a much different animal this year than in previous years. And I hope he will use that opportunity, which Labour leaders haven't always done, to address the nation and not the party. The party is a relatively small, albeit it's bigger than, well, any other party, but it's still a relatively small proportion of the voting population. And to win an election, you have to make yourself credible with, if not a majority, at least around 40-42% of the electorate. And to do that, you've got to address them.
And is this the new normal for the Labour Party now? We've seen the NEC change the rules on the leadership. Is this now going to be a fixed thing for the next few years, or will the Labour Party return to the sort of divisions we're seeing in the Conservative ranks?
I think we are in for a period of dominance by the left of the Labour Party, and what really is the kind of far left of the Labour Party, akin to the right dominance of the Labour Party during the New Labour era. I mean, I think this is going to go on for a decade plus at least, because you've got, I think, three factors. One, the election result means that Corbyn has got at least five more years. Secondly, the influx of these new members, but they're, you know, inspired by this kind of politics. And thirdly, I think you are just seeing a lot of the kind of moderate figures just walking away or deciding to shut up. You know, and I think one of the things that is so interesting is that the Corbynites have been quite clever after the election, because lots of moderates thought, oh, they'll start deselecting us straight away. And indeed, some of the people who would like to fund a new centrist party, they thought that's when their moment would come. But, you know, 20, 30 Labour MPs would get deselected, and then you'd be able to say to people, you're not being disloyal. You've been kicked out of the party, come to us. They're not doing that. They're keeping their powder dry on that front. And I think there's a result of that. You've got moderate Labour MPs keeping their counsel. And I think also Jeremy Corbyn has moved towards their position a bit on the single market. You know, he keeps suggesting that you know, he's now not only open to Britain staying in the single market during transition, but possibly forever. And so they are avoiding giving the moderates a kind of casus belli for a walkout.
So there are no sort of areas that you see potential fireworks?
I think there are some potential fireworks, but not this year. I think that this year it will be, I mean, famous last words, political predictions haven't been particularly accurate recently, but I think this year it will be a relatively quiet conference.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think that if the Corbynistas have got any sense, they won't go around deselecting people for ideological reasons. I have to say that in my experience, and I was one of those involved in the struggle to have a renewable contract as opposed to a safe seat for life in the Labour Party back in the 80s, that it has never done what its opponents always said it would do, i.e. that it would be used by the left for ideological reasons to get rid of people they didn't like. I can only think of about two cases of people who were deselected for because ideologically they were out of line with their local party. One of the effects it's had over the years has been to make MPs a great deal more attentive to their constituencies than they previously were. And another effect has been that a few old stagers who usually stayed an election or two past their sell-by date now decide to retire and not risk trying again for the nomination. A few of the idle and the drunk disappeared in the early stages. Now, actually, the parliamentary party is, on the whole, much younger and much more energetic and much more attentive to their constituencies than was ever the case up to the 1980s, when there were some real shockers parked in safe seats for, well, in the case of Lambeth Vauxhall, where I lived, for 55 years. Mm.
It's a wonderful story about the Labour MP selected for the seat in Yorkshire. Very excited. He calls up and he asks his agent when he should come up. And the agent says, when we need you, we'll send for you.
So are you at all surprised, Chris, about how benign or bloodless this coup has actually been?
Well, I don't really call it a coup. I mean, it was an election. It occurred for two reasons. Jeremy is a product of the Iraq war. He's one of the later bills coming in for the Iraq catastrophe. He came to national recognition because he was one of the leaders of the Stop the War campaign, which had a very good social media network. And when there came a vacancy for the Labour leadership, he found himself up against four relatively lacklustre candidates, all of whom had voted for the intervention in Iraq. And so he was able to make mincemeat of them. There was another factor too, and that is that Ed Miliband, when he was leader, had very unwisely, in my view, opened the party up to anybody who paid £3 or £4 to join. So a lot of people who wouldn't have joined bought themselves a vote for that very low price, and I think that was a mistake. But those are the reasons why... But that's not the explanation why Jeremy got elected. The Iraq one is primarily the explanation.
Is Iraq and the financial crisis. I think those two events served to discredit within the Labour Party New Labour. The fact that you had the Iraq war and then that the economy went the way it did and the banks got bailed out. I mean, those are what provided the opening for Corbynism. I mean, I was just thinking on walking over here from the Commons that, you know, you think back to Chris's book, A Very British Coup. There is this remarkable, I mean, I think there is probably a 30 to 40% chance that Jeremy Corbyn is the next Prime Minister. There is this bizarre possibility that the security services end up answering to Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, who would have thought it? I mean, it is, and how this will be managed, I think, is a very interesting question. I mean, I think it is, and also how does Corbyn approach all these questions of, you know, the Western Alliance, the Five Eyes, all this stuff? You know, how much does he... Because what I've always thought, I mean, Chris would know more than me, but I've always thought what really motivates Jeremy Corbyn is the foreign policy stuff. That is what gets his juices flowing. That is where he is most engaged. And the question of that relationship, if he ever did get to Downing Street, between him and the security services and the foreign policy establishment is an absolutely fascinating one.
Yes, I think the days when the security services messed around in British politics are hopefully over, though I was a bit taken aback to see on the day of the last general election, I was actually walking the South Downs Way, and the Daily Telegraph was on the breakfast table of my bed and breakfast that day, and the front page article was by Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, and a man actually who would have contributed to the misjudgments that led to the Iraq War, and he was warning against a vote for Jeremy or for Labour on the grounds that he thought the security services wouldn't wear it. Well, it's not their business who the electorate choose as Prime Minister. Well, I think MI5 is completely reformed and is understands the democratic process now. I remember a former Tory Home Secretary whispering in my ear after the spycatcher business in the late 80s, "We've cleared out a lot of deadwood." And I think they have. And after Mrs. Rimmington became, and there's been a succession of heads of MI5 since then, and I've had dealings with many of them, they're much more professional and serious people than some of the previous ones. But I'm not sure that MI6 has quite got the message yet.
I mean, there is a valid question about Jeremy Corbyn's views on this stuff, which I think a lot of his stuff gets forgotten. Because to younger voters, it all seems like ancient history. But I mean, there are genuine questions about some of the people that Jeremy Corbyn has chosen to be friends with over the years, and I think the question is, did going off on that in the election campaign in the way that they did, has this vaccinated Jeremy Corbyn against these attacks?
I think one thing we have learned from that election is you can throw all this muck and press all the usual buttons in the tabloids. And it doesn't work anymore. In previous years, it has actually worked, but it would appear that a significant, perhaps minority of the electorate, no longer are no longer switched on by it.
I don't dispute it didn't work. I think the difference between Jeremy Corbyn is that not all of it is muck. Some of it is factual about his...
Well, take Hamas, for example. Or Corbyn is a friend of the IRA terrorists and all the rest of it. Good Lord. Tories have been deploying that one for years, not just against Corbyn, but against all sorts of people, even as they were talking to the IRA in private from 1972 onwards. God Lord, the Army Council of the IRA actually sat in Paul Shannon's living room in Cheyne Walk.
I think this is part of the problem on... Because of the very dubious moral path that the British state went down in Northern Ireland with the peace process, I think to a lot of younger voters, Jeremy Corbyn's contacts with the IRA just make him look like he was slightly ahead of his time.
Yes,
I mean, right. I mean the problem was the deeply, deeply morally compromising approach the British government took to the peace process. The decision to destroy the strategic decision taken by the British government to destroy the political centre in Northern Ireland and empower the extremes in this hope of creating this peace of the extremes.
Well, hang on a minute. There is actually peace in Northern Ireland.
No, there's a peace of the extremes. That is
there is peace in Northern Ireland. The war seems to have stopped.
But that is the moral problem with that is that, you know, if you look at what has happened in Northern Ireland, the Ulster Unionists, the SDLP, have both been wiped out. And that is a conscious decision of the British government.
That's true. I don't think it was a conscious decision. It was a consequence, though, of the peace process, maybe. But it has actually led to 20 years of peace and actually a revival of normal life in Northern Ireland to a large extent. I wouldn't want to go too far. You take the old Hamas one, though. MI6, when I was in the government, were in favour of talking to Hamas. They were trying to persuade the government to talk to Hamas. The thing about Jeremy, you need to put aside all this Jeremy is a friend of terrorist nonsense. Jeremy is the nearest thing to a pacifist in the Parliamentary Labour Party. Now, you can't bash him with both sticks. You can't say he's a terrorist or a friend of terrorists and a pacifist. You have to make up your mind which stick you wish to deploy. And probably they'd be better off trying the other one since the first one doesn't seem to work anymore. Nobody believes it, or most people don't believe it, outside a coven of Daily Express and Mail and Telegraph readers shrinking.
Well, our analysis of Jeremy Corbyn has once again been distracted by Northern Ireland and Hamas. But finally, Chris, James put the probability of Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister at 30 to 40%, is that right?
Yeah, I think something like that.
Where do you put it yourself?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, I say it with utter astonishment. I, I knew Dermy for years. If you look in my memoirs, you'll see a photograph of him sitting in my back garden the day after the catastrophic 1983 general election result, along with other left-wingers. And Dermy's really been on the outer fringes of power ever since, the outer, the most remote fringes. And I'm sure it never occurred to him until very recently that there was a strong possibility of his becoming Prime Minister. I have to say, the learning curve is very steep. And I thought the seminal moment was when we saw him dressed in evening dress at the banquet at Buckingham Palace for the Chinese President. I did run into him shortly after, and I said that seemed to me to be a seminal moment in his political career, and he sort of laughed uneasily.
Paris is worth a mass, yes.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, James. And you can subscribe to Coffee House Shots on the iTunes store and to the magazine itself from just £1 a week. And we'll even throw in a limited edition red Spectator Moleskine notebook. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer.